I don't want a pickle. I just want to ride on my motorcycle.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. This is the Nokomoto Podcast, episode number 198, coming to you from Moto One Podcast Studios Suite. Let's call this the 34th Street Studio.
Well, it's the 35th Street Studio, but...
Oh, sure. Whatever. Well, I mean, it can be whatever street you want it to be. But yes, it's 35th Street Studio, a new location that's been constructed at our demand, okay? Because we don't like to travel too much to do this show. Now, it wasn't in the budget. The president, I mean, we just demanded it. The president just sort of pretended it was a Christmas present for us or whatever, but, you know. That's because he's soft and weak and has no balls. Now, we got a lot of housekeeping to do at the top of this episode. So first, a few people have already sent in some suggestions for worst moments of the show, as well as suggestions for content for all of the games that we're going to play on episode 200. And this will be the third episode in 3 weeks. So we are on track to get the 200th episode out on January 16th, which will be exactly the 5-year anniversary of the show. On that show, we're going to have Dr. Mike with us at least. Any other past guests that want to show up are absolutely encouraged to do so. And we're going to play all the games and read all of the episode 200 related emails. And that should pretty much be the show. For this episode today, we are going to do best worst bike in the world this week. We're going to get through another 2 months worth of emails, at least, let's hope. And we are going to start a multi-part series. It's a special how to sound like you know what you're talking about. On how to sound like you know what you're talking about. And we're going to take about half an hour at the end of this episode to talk about the subtle art of naming names. I'll just leave it at that. Now, we did mention in the last episode that we're putting in an order for some new studio equipment to replace some of these super worn out 5-year-old boom stands that are sagging on us every 5 minutes, replacing a microphone that we talked to death, replacing XLR cables that are sketchy, replacing all sorts of bullshit. That XLR cable that sketched out on us last week, that's the one I just plugged back into this, isn't it?
Yeah, we unplugged it to remind ourselves to throw it out.
Yeah, and then we didn't.
Yeah.
See, we're already working with janky equipment. This is bullshit. Right, so we got that. Then that's going to cost us some Patreon money. We're also going to create a paid ad to try to put the word out about the show. Again, if anyone wants to just send us $100 to help pay for that, that would be excellent. We're going to experiment at the lowest level, which is $100 for this, to see how effective it might be. After that, let's see. Since we determined that a paid ad is worth at least that amount of money, I decided, you know, it's been a while since we've talked about some other shows. At the top of this show here, I think we should give some shout-outs to some other podcasts, right? Because it's been a minute, and apparently this is legitimately having an ad on another podcast on the same topic is the best advertising you can have. So if I just mention these shows to all of our, to thousands of our listeners, that will equate to at least a few, you know, some percentage of new listeners for these other shows, and some percentage of that become Patreon members. So this is, you know, on top of saving them $100 for the ad, this is, you know, Patreon revenue on top of it for these other shows. And since I realize the value of it, I'm just going to give it away for free on our show because we're that kind of show, I guess. So I went on podcastratings.com here and I looked up the top 10 most popular motorcycle podcasts. And I'm going to kind of go down this list in the power rankings, picking out our favorite shows. So weirdly enough, again, at podcastpowerrankings.com, if you type in, I put in moto and motorcycle and then average the two together. And it turns out the number one most popular show is Creative Riding. So if you've not heard Creative Riding, you absolutely should. Junkie Turdmeister, or whatever he goes by, we just call him Junkie, is a dear, dear friend of ours at this point. And it's not just because we're super buddy-buddy that we're mentioning his show. It's because it's an excellent show. He does this show. He might be the only... No, he's not the only motorcycle podcaster who is doing a show by himself. But I'd say he's the one who's putting the most... He's the solo podcaster with the most heart, right? He's mm-hmm. producing original music, segments, well, I guess
co-hosts.
Yeah, he's producing co-hosts. And he's doing all this with no one to bounce off of. So that creates a gigantic editing issue. Trust me. I know what an editing nightmare his show must be. If you try to ever do a recording by yourself, it requires more editing than one with two or three people. Trust me. I'd say it's the most colorful motorcycle show, right? Does that sound right, Swigs?
Yeah.
Yeah. So check that one out. Now, number two most popular motorcycle podcast would be This Motorcycle Life. And Bruce, who produces that show, another good friend of ours. Bruce, I reached out to Bruce when we had six episodes out and he had six episodes out. And I just shot him an email. He shot one right back. And we've been thick as thieves ever since. Bruce is, we've met him in person. We've done his show. And Bruce is just absolute salt of the earth. And on top of that, turns out an amazing podcaster. He puts out episodes a lot less frequently than every other show, but they're amazing. It's basically, the name says it all. It's Moto This American Life. He finds amazing stories that you would never hear anywhere else, interviews these people, and just gets the best out of them. And he does it in just that super sweetheart Canadian way that only the Canadians can do. And I know I just said he's Canadian, but it does not have the maple-y stench of Canada all over it. It is very... I'd say this show is very international, listen friendly. It's not North America centric or anything. It is just motorcycle centric and is absolutely worth your time. You're cheating yourself if you don't listen. So Swigs, do you have a guess at the third most popular motorcycle show in the world?
Ooh, is it Cleveland Moto?
No, it was us.
Oh, okay.
Cleveland Moto is like eighth or something, but we'll get there. Okay. I think Cleveland Moto is eighth, right above, or they're above or below Motorcycles and Misfits, but like one place, I can't remember. So another show that I think podcasters sort of in our zone overlook, I think the show has a lot of listeners, doesn't necessarily need the bounce in advertising, but I really personally appreciate Moto Week. Have you ever listened to Moto Week much, Swigs?
Oh, the MotoGP one?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
I half of the MotoGP news that we talk about, I just steal from Moto Week. I mean, I'll just be honest. Like, he does all the research for us. This guy reads every article, reads everything on every website, watches every video. It like as soon as something's hot off the press, he's on it. He delivers that show religiously, even during the off season. He'll give you testing news and updates. If someone's switching teams, I mean, you know, he's there with it. He what was his name? Anderson? Is that what he just says his first name? And I can't remember. His name is unimportant, but he does the show by himself. And I can't remember if, like, he does the show frequently from hotel rooms and stuff, like sets up in the closets and just wherever he is, just does the show by himself on a little like Tascam recorder or something. But it sounds great. He's got great little audio clips that he throws into it for joining segments. I kind of came up with our rev limiter sound kind of based off of him putting a little like motorcycle zoom noise, like Doppler zoom noise in between segments. Yeah. If you're into, and what's really great too, is it's information heavy and they're like 23 minutes. So it's one of those things too, where I'm listening to it and then someone says something to me and I realize I've got to play half the episode back because I just missed a huge amount of info. It's just straight info dump. It's great. And he does have a showmanship quality about him too, because a thing he tends to do that always pleases me is towards the end of every season, he will constantly be breaking down what results will stretch out the championship points wise. You know, he'll be like, listen, I know it sounds like a long shot, but such and such could still win if such and such rider has four DNFs in a row. And it's great. It's really, really great. He'll be like, you know, you can't count them out because mathematically, if these things happen, and that's really fun. So we're on to the fifth. What's a show that you want to give a shout out to, Swigs?
Oh, well, you really hit all the good ones already. I'm not sure. We should shout out Cleveland Moto. Not that they need the...
Well, we've got to skip down to ninth on the most popular. But yes, yeah. We'll do that. So Cleveland Moto, great friends of ours also. We've camped with these guys. We've... actually, we didn't go to Vegas with them, but we've been to conventions with them. We've shared Airbnbs with them. So, you know, if they're willing to put up with us and we're willing to put up with them, there's a certain magic there, right? And, I'll occasionally be a little rough on them and kind of poke fun at them on our show. But that's because I like them, you know? I wouldn't do that to a true enemy, right? Like,
right.
Yeah, I'll say this about Cleveland Moto. Having met a lot of podcasters in person, when you talk about people who are very genuine on microphone, Cleveland Moto would have to be up at the top. What you hear is what you meet in person.
Absolutely, yes.
We have amped up personalities on microphone. But for sure, with Cleveland Moto, like especially Phil, but really all of them, what you hear on the microphone is what you get. And they go to a lot of events and everything. It's really worth listening. And then you show up and you introduce yourself and you meet them if you're anywhere, going to anything. They'll show up at some point, and you know, that's a great interaction to have. And also, it's just a fairly reliable podcast, which is becoming an issue. There are so many new motorcycle podcasts. If you go into Apple Podcasts or Spotify, whatever, and you put in moto podcast, motorcycles, any different version of search terms, you're going to get a lot of results. But at this point, like one in 11 results is an active podcast or puts out more than two episodes a year. It's ridiculous. I don't know who is just needlessly paying for all this hosting that they're not using, right? Like, is this like a gym membership? And you're like, look, I'll keep paying because I'm going to start going next week, right? I'll put out another episode next week, I promise. And they just never seem to. Moving on. You know what? You know who's like right in the middle of popularity between? Oh, you know what? I'm just getting here a lot. So at at podcastpowerrankings.com, I just saw that Cleveland Moto and the Misfits just swapped 13 and 14th place. Like, it just happened in real time. So just behind both of them is Louisville Vintage Motorworks. So we met these guys at AMA Vintage Days, and super cool dudes. They ran the Kentucky Corner and all the craziness that we've told you about with the Burnout Captain, and the Burnout Pit with the Captain, and the Beer Can Slalom Challenge. These are the masterminds behind that chaos. So they're still kind of getting their start a little bit, but they're putting out shows, they're doing the Lord's work, and we're going to have them on our show here pretty soon. We were trying to get them on our show desperately, but then we ran into a bunch of drama that delayed us putting out our own show to begin with. So we're gonna help them out with their numbers a little bit, because, I mean, we can get more listeners than Cleveland Moto, right? And then finally, we got to talk about the Misfits. That love them or hate them, they're setting the standard, right? You know, when I look at how many motorcycle podcasts are showing up that have absolutely no soul, looking at you, Triumph for the Ride podcast, right? Looking at you, High Side, Low Side, just these kind of, like, there's a couple kind of corporate motorcycle podcasts out there that just are whatever, right? For content that is, you know, really generated from listeners, for listeners, they set the bar. That's all there is to it. Liza really lives and breathes motorcycle events. You know, we do a lot of just talking about just bullshit, the kind of shit you just fly around your garage, just bullshitting. They really hit the nuts and bolts and, like, boots on the ground is what I say, where they excel. If you kind of want to talk, if you live anywhere near the West Coast and you want to talk about events and going to motorcycle things and doing motorcycle things, they're your people. We're just sort of that earworm that, you know, helps you learn how to bullshit, right?
Essentially, yeah.
So there you go. That's enough. Maybe next week we'll mention some more shows, because I'm sure I've left out a bunch of things. I listen to a lot of motorcycle podcasts, so I'm just kind of skimming the surface of good stuff here, but we're almost 20 minutes into this and we have yet to really get to some hardcore motorcycle content. So Swigs, now that the housekeeping's out of the way, what do you say we do best worst bike?
Let's do it.
Okay. So it is time for best worst bike in the world this week. This is the part of the show where we have each already chosen a motorcycle. And unlike last week, this week it generally is a surprise. We do not know what each other have chosen. One will be the best bike in the world this week, and one will be the worst bike in the world this week. Now remember, it's just a fun way to have a conversation about two motorcycles that you might not normally look at in this way, okay? And you know what? New rule. Don't email in to contact@nokomotopodcast.com until you've left a 5-star rating somewhere. All right. Like the hero that left us a rating on Apple Podcasts this week, 5-star review. It just said they talk about motorcycles and scooters. Fucking direct and to the point. Sometimes people leave a fucking novel explaining their whole bike history or what episodes they've listened to, and I love it when people do that and they share that with us and the world. But that is a review that will probably get more listeners than any other review has. Just, they talk about motorcycles and scooters. Boom. Because weirdly, some motorcycle podcasts don't talk about motorcycles. So anyway, leave that review, then you can email us with your critiques of our critiques. Swigs, you have worst bike in the world this week.
I do.
And are you ready to reveal it?
I am.
Okay. And the worst bike in the world this week is...
The Victory.
Uh-oh.
V92C.
Huh. I don't know much about this. What do we got here? Oh, this one. Okay.
So, this was a very early, well, early-ish Victory. And this was, this is back when, you know, Bombardier realized, hey, people who buy snowmobiles and jet skis also...
Is this Polaris?
Yes. Or Polaris. Yeah, they're not the same, are they?
No, BRP is different.
Yeah. Okay, but yeah, so yeah, Polaris. And they realized, hey, people who buy jet skis...
Well, one's Canadian, eh? And the other's from, like, Minnesota. They're both very northern. I think Polaris is, like, kind of... Maybe it's...
I thought they were both Canadian, but maybe not.
No. Victory's American. Polaris is American. For okay. Sure.
Anyway. What they realized, though, is that people who buy recreational vehicles like side-by-sides and four-wheelers and snowmobiles and jet skis tend to buy motorcycles, too. So they, you know, they started up with Victory, and they're like, "Oh, let's make some motorcycles, let's sell to our core audience." And in 98, they unveiled this, and it's got some interesting things about it. For one thing, the way the fins are set up on this motor, it does very much look like a snowmobile engine that got split in half and just rearranged into a V-twin. And there was a particular selling point about this motorcycle. And that is that with an additional 7 cubic centimeters, it was the largest displacement motorcycle at the time.
Oh, bigger than the Rocket 3 at the time. Actually, there may not have been a new Rocket 3. There was no Rocket 3
at the time. No, they were beating out the Goldwing. So this is a 92 cubic inch, so 1,507 cc motor. And they're like, go big or go home. Let's make the biggest motorcycle. But there are a few problems with it. It's not a great motor. I can
spot
motor.
Three right away.
So you would think, oh... If we've got the biggest motor, the biggest displacement motor, it's gotta be pretty good. Like it's got, I mean, with that much displacement, it needs to make some power, right? Well, as Harley has taught us, not really. This motor was getting about 67 horsepower and about 70 foot-pounds of torque.
For 98, I would call those decent numbers, honestly.
Well, they would be if the Valkyrie hadn't come out the year before with 110. And
Okay. There's the Valkyrie, sure, but that's so that's such a radical departure from the classic American cruiser aesthetic.
Biggest motorcycle in the world, largest displacement. You've got to have some numbers to back it up.
Well, okay, so the Valkyrie is a superior bike to this in every conceivable way, which I think is something 2 or 3 years ago you would have fought me on, but you've fully come around. And not only that, like people think of the Valkyrie as, oh, it's a Honda, blah, blah, blah. But as we know, like, no, made in Ohio, pure American steel. But this is trying to be a Kawasaki Vulcan. I'm really good at spotting, you know, metric cruisers and all this other stuff. Just the outline of the bike, I'm usually dead nuts on. But if you took the Victory logo off of this and put it next to a debadged Vulcan, it would take me a minute, and I'd have to look at that and go, oh, that is an early Victory motor. Okay, I've got it. Because both the bikes, are pretending to be air-cooled and are, in fact, liquid-cooled. And they're both a little bit ashamed of it. And this one is even more ashamed of it than the Vulcan. To the point that they've made the radiator on this
as small as they can, and put it down
as low as they can so it fits in between the down tubes of the frame.
No, so that's not a small...
is that just a big oil cooler?
Yeah, it's not a small liquid... That's not a small coolant radiator. That's a big-ass oil cooler.
Oh. Okay. I assumed that was a small radiator. Okay.
No.
So this is still... Okay, so this is just fully air-cooled. Just the fins really are that weird. Because they look like the fake cooling fins on a Vulcan, don't they?
They kind of do, yeah.
They're very similar non-Harley cruiser V-twins.
No, they're just trying...
This one really is air... Okay,
they're trying. Right. They're trying to get as much air cooling as possible, you know, because of...
Well, that explains your low numbers. It's still air-cooled.
Exactly. Well, this is the second point of why this is the worst bike in the world. Victory really didn't start getting cool until they started producing the liquid-cooled cruisers like the Octane. Once they went liquid-cooled and they just said, hey, the Harley track of big air-cooled cruiser doesn't have to be the status quo. Let's modernize and let's envision a cool modern American cruiser. And this was just sticking to the old formula. And this was the wrong track.
So I think that Polaris Indian is sort of the Trump administration of motorcycle design.
Okay.
I think, and I really do believe, that Victory, when they were putting out the Victory Vision, the Octane or whatever, right? It was very Obama years. And it was sort of like, it was a new direction for America. Like, there was noticeable improvement in those. Like, things are going pretty damn good. And some people were fighting it a little bit, but there was this new aesthetic in motorcycle design. And if you look back at it, look at those, like, 2000 to 2010 Victory, 2014, 2000, yeah, 2000 to 2014 Victories. And look at the cool angular designs and the flat surfaces meeting round surfaces sort of thing. Like, look at the 8-ball and look at the Victory Vision and the Victory Octane. And it is distinctly American, and it is definitely not Harley Davidson derived.
Yeah.
Whereas this is like not even Harley derived. It's like metric cruiser derived, what we're looking at here.
And this is a forgery of a forgery, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, some people disliked it, but the Victory faithful were really like, no, this is great stuff. This is really cool. This is looking forward. And we could have taken it a step further, especially the aesthetic of the Octane, like right before it all ended, with just some of the coolest shit they ever put out. And all of a sudden, everyone went, nope, make America great again. Remember the 1950s? Let's do that again.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, are you fucking kidding me? Like, we almost had something that wasn't just trying to be the 1950s in American motorcycles.
I mean, they were already part-sharing so much. They should have just merged the factories. You know, they make the bikes jelly bean style anyway.
I would have liked to have seen Victory and Buell merge together in like 2014 and just have a real fucking go at it. You know, like, let's just put these both under one umbrella. Buell will be the sport brand of Victory, and Victory do the cruisers. Buell will do all the performance stuff, and like, boom, here we go. Let's make some dirt bikes while we're at it. Just go. And no, they're like, eh. Let's create motorcycles that people who would still watch reality TV will buy.
A little bit, yeah.
Nothing bores me more than a Polaris Indian.
I like a lot of Indians, but they did take away... They took Victory from us.
Well, the only Indian I like is the one that's just a Victory Octane with different bodywork.
Yeah.
It's the only one I like. I mean, they haven't even updated the motors. They're still just that last generation of Victory motors. And they're great motors, but... Anyway, so yeah, this is a copy of a copy. This is not even as good as a Vulcan.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not terrible. It's just that virtually everything else is a better option. It would have to be so cheap. Like, it would have to be like someone crashed it. And it needs new forks, and there's a dent in the tank, and like, hey, give me $1,300 for it. It runs. And it's like, okay.
I mean, but it's I'll
ride it with a dented tank, and it'll just be cool to have a 90s Victory that no one cares about. And I can park it outside and never put a tarp on it and never fucking care, right? It'd be like buying like a used pickup truck, but as a motorcycle.
Yeah, I mean, you also have to remember... Get it real
dirty and crusty.
You have to remember, 25-year-old bike from a manufacturer that doesn't exist anymore. It's going to be tough.
Yeah. Well, is this fuel-injected or carbureted?
It is fuel-injected.
I thought it would be, yeah. That was one thing that they were good about early on. But yeah, that rear fender, man, that is... And that front fender, that is all Kawasaki Vulcan.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was also technically Indian before, but... Although no, that front fairing with the straight top and then in the swoop on the back, that is very, very...
That's Vulcan. That's a little bit Harley, too, with it going out straight at the top and then curved to the back, but it's... But again, like... The Vulcan is just a cheaper Road King. And then this is just a different Vulcan. It's kind of Vulcan fenders with a Harley tank, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a fair way to put it.
Yeah, it's a little gross. It doesn't have its own identity. They were really trying to establish the company and they're poking around in the dark at this point, so I can't be too mean, but at the same time it's like their motors hadn't gotten real good yet. This is like a Triumph Bonneville America, right? When you go like, oh, is this like a new Triumph and an old Triumph, and you're like, well, it's a new Triumph technically. But it's like, this is kind of before Hinkley Triumph got good.
Right.
Like, you know, it's like, oh, I've got a Triumph Thunderbird. Like, oh, you do? Like one of those like new, like big twin ones? No. This is the triple. Wait, what year is this from? Oh, like 99 or like, you know, 97 or whatever. Like 97. Yeah, this is the one where the middle cylinder overheats. This isn't. You know, they've got the triples figured out now, but there was a time when it wasn't good and they were kind of rediscovering themselves. That's what this is for Victory. Avoid. Like,
I mean, it's kind of more like their Bonneville America.
Right. And you know, there's a certain romanticism to it, but I would definitely just stamp this like avoid. You know, if you're on Craigslist, just scroll past. Don't be tempted by this. Okay, you ready to talk about something really cool?
Let's do it.
All right. And the best bike in the world this week is easily the coolest sport bike that no one ever fucking talks about. When we're talking about classic 80s, when we're talking about landmark big displacement bikes... This should be in every conversation and is frequently missing. This is the 1984 to 1986 Honda VF1000R. This is one of just the coolest looking, just high performance bikes of all fucking time. So this is in the US, I think it was just 85, 86, but I think Europe got it in 84. So this is a V4 90 degree. So not even V, this is really an L4. Liquid cooled, double overhead cam, 1 liter, full on sport bike.
Whoa. Okay.
117 horsepower at the crank, 92 claims Cycle Magazine at the time. But this is just, this is like a year after the Ninja. And let me bring up some better pictures for you to look at here, Swigs, because this is, styling-wise, years ahead of what Kawasaki was doing. When you look at pictures of this, it's really, first of all, it's gorgeous. It is absolutely gorgeous, and it has styling that in a lot of ways holds up today. I mean, it's clearly a bike from the 80s, but it has a certain sensibility about it, especially this single headlight version I'm about to bring up for you. Look at the contour of this tank, right? Look at the huge, you know, single piece bodywork. Look at sort of the contours of the seat. I mean, look at this photo right here. This doesn't look 80s. I mean, it looks more late 90s than anything else.
It does, yeah. One thing, just looking through pictures here that I can see, is every picture, except for one of them, they've all got those red fork covers.
Oh, yeah.
Which is an interesting signature. But
I think those are just painted. They just painted the fork lowers. These are not inverted forks.
Oh, okay.
But they did paint them because this is a premium bike. Like back when that meant something. But like this is 1984 and this is not a square swing arm. Like this was not built to a price point. It's a full-on twin spar frame, but it's that steel twin spar frame like you get on the early GSXR 750s.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of looks like a GSXR 750 that they put more design work into.
Yeah.
Like if you look at a GSXR 750, a first-year one today, it kind of looks a little unfinished in some ways, and this one is obviously a lot more thought out. I mean, the tank design is just beautiful, but I love the back of the seat there. I love that that passenger seat cowl cover. I love the colors. I love everything about it. The exhaust is cool. The single headlight is cool. I think the European version has like a double headlight thing.
The Golden Wing logo on it.
Yeah, it's fantastic. But the performance is fantastic too. This was 150 miles an hour top speed, supposedly, claimed at least anyway. This was the fastest production bike in 1984. So that's super fucking cool. And I mean, a Honda L twin. That's not the Super Hawk, right? Or an L4. Sorry. Did anything else even have this motor?
I don't know. You can just see from the width of the seat compared to the rest of the body just how gigantic this bike is.
Yeah. A lot of people complained with its rear set pegs and its handlebars, its clip-ons, that it was a really aggressive riding position. Apparently these days, it's actually considered a fairly relaxed ride. But in 84, people were like, what the fuck? You're really leaning over this thing. And Honda was like, it's a sport riding position. Fucking deal with it. And people did, obviously. But it's supposedly, if you sit on one today, it's nowhere near as bad as like a modern 600. But yeah. It's a long wheelbase. She's a big girl. I can't remember the weight, but it's like high 500s. She's a big girl. But that's fun. I love a big girl. Like, this has got... It's a really meaty bike, you know? And yeah. That's... I don't know. It's somehow really satisfying. The graphics are just off the charts cool. That VF1000 with the big R and like the weird zeros that kind of look like letter A's or something. I don't know what's going on there, but that's great. You've got like all the branded technology from the time, like written on the bike in places, like ProLink suspension, and it's got like the anti-dive forks that are called something or other. These are like the Goldwing forks from the time. You've got like the Honda Racing, like HRC company logos on here. Yeah, the old school golden Honda wings. I mean, it's just all there. And I can't get enough of it. It's too cool. It's just too fucking cool. It was very high tech. All the suspension front and back is all adjustable, which was not a standard thing at the time at all. I'm not sure if there were really like any race wins for this thing. If it did any open class racing and won anything of note, I'm not sure. I think this was just more a statement than anything else, because just every few years, a company just had to put out something fucking bonkers or you were just going to get forgotten. Right. You know, this period, you know, from 1969 to 1999, if you didn't have the world's fastest or the world's biggest or the world's biggest displacement or the world's fastest 0 to 60, like at least every other year, you are becoming irrelevant. This is right in the middle of the speed wars.
Right.
You know, like this is right in the middle of it, and boom, this is a model of note. When everyone's talking about GPZ 900s and Gixxer 750s and, you know, all this other 80s stuff, somehow this one gets left out of the conversation a little bit.
Well, to a degree, I think it's fair, because I mean, it's always the move that, like, everyone's happy to just take an already high performance motor that's a little questionable and just slap a turbo on it, which happens quite frequently throughout time. Or somebody's willing to just up the compression ratio, shorten the lifespan, or do, you know, tune up the top end of an already high performance motor. And everyone kind of wants to do it with inline fours because, well, we're already making lots of inline fours, and they're kind of cheap to make. And if you look at a lot of the big Speed Wars bikes, a lot of them are inline fours. Some of them get blown up to 1200 or 1100 or 1300, or you get a turbo on them. But it's basically like, let's just stick with the inline four because they're cheap. But every once in a while, somebody says, let's do the V4.
Yeah.
Who cares what it costs? Let's do the premium V4. You know, that's what Ducati did a few years ago. And it worked. It got a lot of attention.
Yeah.
It won races. But it's kind of a power move.
Oh, it's absolutely a power move. Honda couldn't bring this back today because it would just cost too much. And it wouldn't have enough prestige to justify the extra cost.
Exactly. Right? Yeah.
They really need to bring back this paint scheme, though.
Every one of these paint schemes is fantastic.
The problem with these paint schemes is you just can't do them anymore because there's not enough bodywork anymore.
True.
that they have to do like cut down versions. In all, and these pictures that I found, there's a couple bikes that are sort of like
the only bike that's done something.
What would a modern version of this look like today? And
I think the only thing about this that that is the only modern bike that has pulled off something kind of like this is the CBR 1000 Triple R.
Right, but again, there's so little body work over the whole thing that it
yeah.
It is red, white, and blue, and it is cool, but it doesn't quite it doesn't yeah, I don't know. I don't know. It's just not the same. I can't get over how much I love this tank design. It's so cool. It's contoured, but it's also 80s angular at the same time. It's every bit of this bike just does it for me. That great big wide seat, but it's still contoured and very with the sport tail. And then the whole thing ends like very square at the back, but it's rounded at the front.
One really weird feature on this that you would never see on a bike to, well, you definitely wouldn't because a modern bike would be fuel injected, but the massive dial petcock.
I love that. Honda put that on the CB1000 as well, the CBR1000, or is it the CB1000F? One of them, like the... They had a big 1000 like cruiser, like sport tour kind of bike like this.
Oh, the CBR1000F?
That sounds right. The CBR1000F, yeah. And that had the same, it may have been the same tank, but it was definitely the same like petcock built into the side there. It's great. It's wonderful. Rather than try to hide it somewhere that you can't feel it, like when you're riding along, it's so Honda just to go like, how do we solve this problem?
Let's just make it 3 inches tall.
Yeah, let's go for it. I love it. Yeah, I want to look at more specs on this thing again. I've already forgotten what they are. It was like big torque for the time too. How much was? Oh, the weight is. The full wet weight of this bike is 610 pounds.
I like it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not quite concourse territory. All right.
You know, I guess we've got to, at the same time, we've got to talk about, like, this was a big V4 era for Honda. So this is like the days of the V45. That they put in the Saber and the not the Shadow, what's the other one? The Magna, the V45 Magna, and of course there's the VF750, the RC30, right? Or the VFRs as well start at this era. And you know, I don't know why, besides cost, Honda got away from it, but for a while, Honda was kind of known for V4s. This mid to late 80s, and then even through the 90s with the VFR, they really had a lot of great V4s. I don't know what the fuck happened to this. I'm going to have to do some digging, but it must just be a cost thing, right?
I'm going to guess, well... I mean, I'm be totally pulling this out of my ass, but my guess would be that the Southeast Asian market just opened up. Early to mid 80s, end of the Vietnam War, when everything kind of cools down. Huge market.
Yeah. Oh, this is a shaft drive bike as well. I forgot to mention that. I'm pretty sure it's shaft drive. Maybe it's not. Maybe the kind of touring version was shaft drive. I may be making that up. Hold on. Yeah, I think I'm making that up. Am I? No, I'm not sure. I think this might be shaft drive. Let me find a shot of the other side of this bike. Because it doesn't, my spec sheet isn't telling me. I feel like an idiot. I should already know this. It's like off the top of my head. Where is this thing? Come on, come on, come on. Wheelbase, ground clearance, dry weight, curb weight.
This is a great pod.
I know, right? Displacement value. Oh, this also is the beginning of Honda's gear-driven cams.
Oh.
I don't know if it's the very first model, but this predates the VFR with its gear-driven cams. So, this was kind of a new move for Honda. So, like, how reliable or good the gear-driven cams are in this, I don't know. But if you have one, that is definitely something that you get to lord over VFR gear-driven cam people. And you can just be all over the forums like, well, guess what? Blah, here we go. I've got the best, you know? Gear ratios. Final drive chain. Yeah, it is chain drive. Sorry. It would be insane for this to be shaft drive. Although it was just the pure like heaviness of it that made me think, well, isn't this like chain drive then or something? No. There's some version that is shaft. Anyway.
You know what? Outrageously, Europe got this before us.
I know. I know.
Which I just learned on Bikes Wiki, which if you're looking for Japanese, any info on Japanese bikes, this is now the go-to, I think.
It is, clearly.
This is the most comprehensive.
This bike, this is a very small note, but it's something I want to point out about this bike. I've not really seen this on other bikes. For whatever reason, this bike has twin brake lights, and I love it.
Yeah, why not?
Why not? Yeah, it's premium. It's got two brake lights, you know? I'm all about it. They seem to be very rare, very expensive. You'll probably just never see one in your whole life. And, I mean, I guess that's fine. But, you know, the next time you see something, you know, VF1000R, if it catches your eye, you know, now you know to stop and go, oh, it's not a 1 liter VFR. This is a VF1000R. This is a different bike. This is a 90 degree L-twin. This is gear driven cams. This is all the bells and whistles. Honda pulling out all the stops. In an era of 750s and whatever, this went bam, 1 liter, fastest bike. Go fuck yourself. Pretty fucking cool. And again, just the, I think the styling holds up. I think, you know, there's a couple things you would look at this to make, and it would seem dated. You'd be like, those are kind of small tires for, you know, a bike with this much horsepower. And you'd be like, that frame doesn't look totally optimized.
I do kind of love now. I didn't like it before, but I really do kind of love now this era, like 80s sport bikes with frames that really just don't look up to the task.
The skinny frames?
Where the frames just haven't caught up with the horsepower.
Well, the weird thing is that these frames are just made of a heavier, stiffer metal.
Right.
The aluminum frames have to be so much bigger because they have to be hollow and they have to just have all this sort of framework supporting each other. So overall, they're lighter, but they are bigger.
Right.
And it's a game that they play. You know, you're losing some volume in the bike, but overall it's lighter. So that's a big, it's, you know, it's just different things.
Well, unless you're a Kawasaki Z1 RTC, in which case your frame really isn't good enough.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, the Z1 RTC was still like a tube frame. It wasn't even like this solid steel frame that we get.
Yeah.
Anyway. All right, cool. Let's see, do we want to take a quick break or do we want to roll into emails?
Let's take a quick break.
All right, we'll be back with emails in just a moment. And we're back with some emails. Swiggy might not be totally drunk, but he's had at least a few beers, so
well, I'll catch up.
Yeah. We may or may not catch up totally on the emails here. We'll see. I guess we're making some progress. Because we knocked out like 6 of them last week.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's see what we got.
I mean, I've been skipping over and replying to a bunch, but these are ones of note. It has been filtered down a little bit.
Oh, okay.
Actually, here's one that we did miss, though, back in August. this is from John, and he sent us an email saying, finished a 1,300-mile solo loop of Lake Michigan on my Z900RS and caught up to some Nokomo episodes along the way. If you ever come out this way, hit up the Throttle Stop Museum. That's a stone's throw away from Road America. They actually have that crazy turbo Z1 Kawasaki that was a past worst bike in the world, along with a whole lot of other cool shit. Anyway, keep fighting the dragon. And he sent us a whole bunch of photos from the museum, which includes a Z1, a Kawasaki Z1 RTC.
Yes.
A bunch of really cool, like, first year H3s and old CBs and all sorts of cool stuff. This museum does look rad. Yeah, I mean, ultimately it's just a lot of pictures.
Well, let's get back to a 1,300-mile loop on, you said, a Z900RS?
Yes.
Okay, I mean, that gets you to hero status, because that's certainly not an uncomfortable bike, but for 1,300 miles, that's not my first choice. And also, how many hours are we talking about to complete this? Was this like a super hardcore iron butt, or was this like 4 days? I want to know.
Yeah, you should let us know. We will read it.
Probably in January, but you will read it. Yeah.
Yeah. We won't put it off till April.
Exactly.
We'll be good this time, I promise.
We need to hit up more motorcycle museums. We've driven by so many, but we're always in such a hurry everywhere that we're going on these road trips.
Yeah, we do kind of build it up. We do kind of plan them that way.
Yeah. Okay. What else we got here?
All right. So we got one from Ken, who says, I finished watching Knight Riders with your commentary at 1:30 in the morning today. The ZBX had an aftermarket 6x6 exhaust. I had a 79 in that color, but without the tacky chrome stripe like the King's. After the crash at the end, it did look like one of the factory pipes was lying on the road in the wreckage. They got the sound correct, except towards the end when he was going down the road with Blackbird, and it sounded like it was just off idle. The CB750 was a Honda-matic. The rider rode a half circle while carrying the notorious mace in his left hand. It came to a stop without touching the bike. I then looked for the clutch lever, and it wasn't there.
Good spot.
The lawyer's Gaudi bike was a Water Buffalo, and they got that sound right. The side hacks had Earl's fork type front suspension, and one of them, if not both, was definitely a Yamaha XS650. And he also sent a picture of him with his CBX right after the film was released.
So I know that in Europe there was a 6x6 factory option, but I don't know that that was an option in the U.S. So this was either a foreign import bike, or they just were like, oh, did you know this other crazy exhaust is available on the aftermarket?
Oh, I think they were just like, just get us a bunch of cool, ridiculous bikes. And honestly, they don't know. Probably the people, the props department, probably didn't know what was original and what was not and what they were getting. And they just bought a bunch of stuff.
This is a nice CBX that he's got here. Although, how old is he in this picture? How did he afford this bike? What was his job when he was like 19 or however old he is here? Because this looks like a 79 that he's got here. Did he say in the email what year his CBX was? I don't
don't know.
I don't know.
The CBX is one of these legendary bikes that I don't think anyone under the age of 60 can really talk about, because just with all six cylinders and six carburetors and all the potentials for air leaks and just the suspension wearing down over time, the cost that it must be to get one operating like they did in 1979 to 83 or whatever must be so ridiculous. I don't know if anyone has really experienced a CBX unless they had one new.
That's probably fair. Yeah, the overlap of people under 30 who also have the experience with carburetors and the patience to do a rack of six of them is probably pretty slim. And who also have the shop space to do it with, you know, even just replacing the gaskets
right
on six on cylinders.
The float bowls, yeah. And then, yeah, all the gaskets on all the heads.
It's well, just, I mean, today you'd have to pull the jugs off and replace all the gaskets and everything. Like, you'd have to tear that thing down.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, and no one's got the time or money for it. And but again, after even after you throw all that money into the engine, you've got to throw all that money into, you know, redoing your suspension and your brakes and your everything. And, you know, like even to the point where like, well, are just all the splines on the handlebars going to be ground down and there's just a lot more vibration or wiggle and it feels like, you know, and it just feels like the bike's made of Jell-O. And it's like, are you going to replace that shit too? Or just like give it an extra tighten and hope that that stops your handlebars from moving? I don't know. They just made so many more CB750s. There's a few good survivors out there. Like Dad's, it only had like 1,200 miles on it. Like you ride that thing and you're like, this is pretty good. They couldn't have been much better than this when they were new.
It's the sort of thing that, yeah, because the 750s were produced in such large quantities that, and they weren't so precious or so expensive at the time, that it was enough for it to be kind of an ill-advised purchase for somebody to get one and then just put 1,000 miles on it and then forget about it under a tarp in their air-conditioned garage for 30, 40 years. And then pull it out and sell it to somebody for not much money. That didn't really happen with these. This is a little step up.
Yeah, I don't know. I've just heard a lot of people talk shit about them, and I've heard a lot of people over-romanticize them. And I just don't know that I really trust the opinion of anyone that didn't have one new at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm just going to go with that. So, yeah, email us back again and let us know, how good was this CBX? Was it the legend that everyone hopes that it was? Or, you know, was it a better CB750? Or was it kind of like not great handling, like, you know, maybe just a bit smoother than some other bikes? Or, you know, what was the deal with it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if you send us another email, we will respond, unlike your one recently asking us if we were going on the toy run, which we both completely forgot about and weren't reading the emails.
Well, in my defense, wait, is he a Colorado guy?
Yeah. Well, he was asking about the toy run.
Oh, the Greeley toy, the sleigh. Oh, sure.
Oh, the sleigh ride. Yeah.
Oh, fuck. Well, then I have to ask another follow-up question. Do you still have this CBX or, No, but yeah, we did not do the toy run this year, which is my fault. But in my defense, it's been the Sunday before Christmas for like 10 years. And this year it was two Sundays before Christmas. And I woke up and I was driving to work and I was opening the restaurant and I just see all these bikes and my heart just sank. I was like, fuck. But you know what? I did put all the toys on the Vespa and I rode like 4 blocks down to the police station and I donated all the toys in our name. So we bought the toys and, you know, and I rode him down there on the scooter. In a way, we kind of did the run 2 days later. But yeah, all right. What other emails we got?
We got a Patreon message from John, who says, glad you guys didn't lose that episode. Can't remember which one because it's a while ago. Oh, this is the October episode. Okay. And he said, it was a great one. I'm also tired of being told electric motorcycles are the only option in the future.
Yeah, remember, this is about that time I did that rant. We were talking about things that were just fucking over. And I was like, you know what I'm over? Electric bikes. I'm preemptively just over them. But, you know, weirdly, it's worth mentioning, the very next week, Cleveland Moto put out an episode where Phil started the show with this huge rant about being pissed off about not electric motorcycles, but electric motorcycle vaporware.
Oh, he's caught up. Oh, no. Yeah. So just check out Electrek. There's so much. Most electric motorcycle companies are a website.
Yeah. Seriously, we could probably like sell advertising and be way more popular than our podcast if we just created an electric bike website and we just made everything up. Like everything was just a weird 3D render.
I feel like I did a segment on this like 2 or 3 years ago.
Probably, but it would be completely worth it, right? Not worth it. I mean, doable though, to just like 100% make up everything. Just every week, make up 3 different new company names, 3 different designs. Just like we just have like throw a dart at a dartboard. It's like that's how many wheels it's going to have. Yeah. Or that's what the voltage is going
to
be.
We've got to make the first 5-wheeled electric vehicle.
Yeah, and it's good. Yeah, again, we're just throwing darts, so it's like, oh, it's like 40,000 watts with and 2 volts. Yeah. just whatever. Just every conceivable different setup.
We've got a really sweet -30 amp motor here.
Right. You know? Yeah. Yeah, this one is weirdly a hub motor, and it's in frame. You know, it's dual motor. You know, and just do all the dumb things. But the idea that motorcycles have to be electric is dumb to me because, especially in the United States, it's such a small percentage of the traffic. That if we moved all the passenger cars to being electric, or just half of the passenger cars to being electric, I mean, the motorcycle traffic is really just totally negligible. Okay, whatever. How many emails we got left here?
We got a couple.
All right, let's just get through them then.
Okay, so we did get a Patreon message from Leon. Again, he said, FYI, despite the advice of everyone I know, including my brain, I am vibing hard on a 2014 Honda NC750. Vibing hard, he says.
Look at this. Like, we had those emails, like, all enjoying the scooter content. Now we've got this other freak show of a bike fetishist into an NC750. I love the NC750. I don't know why so many people hate. You know, I don't think people do hate it. I think moto journalists hate it.
I think so too.
Yeah, I don't see how it's not a complete, just total alternative to, say, a oh my god, what's the bike that I was talking about last week? Where it was people were like, "It's a real adventure bike." What are you talking about?
I don't remember what we did last week.
Not the baby V-Strom, not the small, but the other one, the Kawasaki. What's the Kawasaki not adventure bike, but trying to be an adventure bike?
Oh, the KLX?
No. No, the KLX is a sort of enduro thing. You're thinking of the KLR, but there's another one.
Or not the, no,
the
not
Versus.
The Versus. There
Jesus
we go. Yeah.
Christ. Yeah, right. So it's a Honda Versus, right? People love the Versus, yet they hate the NC750. Is there a big horsepower difference? I don't know what like the Versus 650 horsepower is.
I want to say it's like it's actually pretty decent, but I think it's like 55. They should be pretty similar.
Yeah, I mean,
Versus, or it might be up to 65.
Let's take a look here. What have we got? Well, Kawasaki's not going to tell us on their website. What have we got in terms of search results for the specs? Bikes.com. What does Bikes.com say it is? This is sure to be an inflated price. But let's see. What's the best possible horsepower?
This says 69.
Okay. So this is like, wasn't it like 54 or 56 or something for the NC750?
It's around there, yeah.
And what's the torque that we're getting on this Versus?
It says 47 here. So,
well, wasn't it also like 55 foot-pounds of torque off of the NC750? Weren't like the torque and the horsepower numbers like almost identical?
I want to say it was pretty high, but let me check. It might only be 40. Let's see.
I thought it was like 50-something horsepower and like 52 foot-pounds of torque. I thought they were pretty close numbers. But that's on the 750 version, not the 700. Remember they bumped it up?
Yeah. So let's see here. So for the 2014 to 15... that was the NC750X. So that was... Let's see.
I remember for the 750 displacement going like, oh, okay.
So it's 54 horsepower. Says 68 newton meters, which is probably about 45, 46 in that range.
Hmm.
So, yeah, 55, 45...
Oh, I thought it was a bit more than that on the torque, but okay, whatever.
Well, no, its gift is incredible fuel efficiency.
Well, it has incredible fuel efficiency and storage, has low weight. It's,
and low center of gravity with the underseat fuel tank.
Right. Well, and the flat motor.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it is not optimized for performance. It is optimized for like living with it. But again, at 50 something horsepower, that's something that, like, you know, we were saying, that's like that minimum amount of horsepower for, you know, iron butt rides, right? Like you can go 400 miles on this, no fucking problem. And that's, or you can commute with it. And these were a bike with an early DCT option, I believe, as well.
Yes.
Yeah, I think like there was just an NC750 DCT, like not even touring, not even whatever,
mm-hmm.
just straight up automatic. And it was kind of like, here's your ultimate commuter. It gets like 67 miles per gallon and it does the gear changes for you. You're welcome. And I don't know, some people think that that's like girly or obnoxious. I think there's totally room for that. And was the bike a little tall or something? Why didn't it not catch on?
I think it just didn't catch on because it was... it's always been a kind of a weird bike. You know, NC, I believe, stands for new concept.
Oh, really?
That's yeah.
So Honda.
It's... They just throw all sorts of weird shit on it.
Well, these are also the days of the NM4 Voltus.
Yeah.
It's a bike I still love, and I still think I need to own one. This is the same. They put the same motor in the Voltus too, didn't they?
Yep.
Yeah. So,
and I think it was DCT as well.
I've recently been seeing some YouTube videos of people test riding Voltuses, and they're like, "This is actually kind of great," because this DCT really makes the most of that horsepower.
Yeah.
Apparently, this is the motor that you do want the DCT version of. Because you don't have to fight it and wring it out in every single gear. it can just do perfect gear changes for you, so it feels like more power than it is.
Right, just because the DCT can do it so much better than you.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't need the extra power to kind of just like over rev the gears and do late shifts or short shifts or whatever.
So you just get to treat it like a CVT essentially.
Yeah. So yeah, I love that this guy's vibing on an NC7. I mean, the NC750X with the DCT is really the version to go for. And I think it's a beautiful thing to max one out with all the bags and touring accessories and taller windshields and everything.
Just we've already got it. The $1 million. We've already got the $1 million KLR.
Yeah, the Dior
or the KLR, the
DR,
the $1 million DR 650. We need the $1 million NC750X.
We really do. Yeah, it needs all the things. So. Yeah, I wonder if the NC was, you know, Honda just throws so much at the wall to see if it'll stick. This was just one that didn't stick. And so they're like, I don't know, let's just try it all with the Rebel platform instead. Maybe that'll work. But, you know, it's starting to fade now, but 4 years ago, if you weren't doing an adventure bike, like, you weren't part of the conversation. You know, and it was all about big adventure bikes, too. It was like, you're not just going to have an adventure. You're going to go to other fucking planets on this thing. Right. People were buying big adventure bikes with big dreams of round the world tours, you know, and not many of those round the world tours happened. Not at all. People barely got to the next state.
There were many a brave adventure along a fire road.
Right.
But, yeah. I mean, some people did, but no. The vast majority of them didn't do all that much adventuring, which is fine, but...
There's also a lot of people doing fancy slow maneuvers and fast maneuvers in parking lots trying to prove that these were the ultimate performance bikes, but it was like, there's better tools for the job. You're doing all that stuff in spite of this bike, not because, you know, it's like when cops brag about their police riding competitions. It's like, there's tons of bikes you can do this with. You don't need a Harley to do this.
Yeah. Meanwhile, you've got, you know, C90 Adventures riding a mini Chinese Jeep from Salt Lake City to Moab.
Yeah, or any number of dumb vehicles. Yeah. I mean,
not that I would choose to spend my time that way. It's a little bit touch and go, you know, especially the minefield, but
The thing that gets me about the NC750 is it's such a perfect first motorcycle, either as the first motorcycle in your garage or the first motorcycle you buy. Mm-hmm. Because you've got your neutral riding position, you've got totally manageable power, you've got Honda reliability, you've got every accessory amenity that you could want, including the frunk, you've got wind protection, you've got, I mean, all the things that will keep you riding, right?
Right.
The only thing is possibly like a higher seat height for someone who's shorter. That's the only possible obstacle. And even then, I think for sort of like those sort of faux adventure bike kind of setups, it's still pretty manageable on the height, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember them. We've only seen and ridden one in person, and that was just a 700. But it was the DCT. But yeah, anyway. I'm curious what this guy, like, he just said, I'm vibing pretty hard. What is the vibe that's speaking to this man? Because we are the only people on the planet that I have encountered that are big fans of this bike. So he now makes three of us. What is it about this bike that's speaking to him? Like, you can tell us you're vibing on it. Is it for the exact reasons we said? Or, like, are you just... Are you just damaged deep down, like, you know, in a way that cannot be healed? I don't know.
Well, those are not mutually exclusive.
They're not. You're right. I want to know why he's drawn to this. We can't close the book until we know that. All right.
All right. All right. We got one more. This is actually a new one. This is from Logan. And Logan says, "Hey, y'all, it's Logan again to let you know I've watched every video of y'all's." Well, I doubt, because we don't have any videos. Well, I guess it's technically true. I assume he means podcast. He says, which is also just, I don't know, it's questionable.
There could be some service out there that's just taking our audio and just putting up static images of, like, the show logo and streaming them as video somewhere.
It's possible. Let us know. And he says, also, I wanted to suggest a segment idea debating super sports versus naked bikes, since there has been a lot of talk on other podcasts the super sport class is dying out. Update on my bike search. I've embraced my naked side and have realized that that practicality makes more sense than looks. I'm looking at the 2022 XSR 900 or MT10. I always look forward to your content and enjoy all the bloopers. For your episode 200 special, I think the most unprofessional moment was when Swiggy got plastered and attempted to read the emails drunk. Can't remember the episode, and frankly, I'm too lazy to look. Hopefully y'all can...
That's a lot of different episodes.
Yeah, I mean, that's not... That really doesn't narrow it down.
The first time was, like, somewhere around, like, episode 8 or something. You were just real... And I just was like, let's just make it a segment. I could try to listen through, like, the first 10 episodes and try to find the first... Because I remember there was one where you were just like, I don't know if I could read... And I'm like, just read them. Let's see what happens. I'll try to find that, but it'd be better if the listeners found it for us, the first episode where you do it. Yeah.
Okay.
So super sports versus naked bikes.
This seems like a false equivalence here.
Well, so the super sport class seems to be reinvented into that 650 700 twin class.
Yes.
And they're kind of upping the torque, lowering the horsepower. They're kind of retuning for the mid-range lowering the cost. And Fort9 just put out a video about this, about how these bikes actually can kind of keep maximum traction for better corner speed, like more than the Supersport 600s. I think it's just really trying to justify this move to have 700 twins instead of awesome 600s. You know, if you ask me, I don't think that these naked bikes or this new interpretation of the super sport class are anywhere near as good as classic 600 RR bikes. They're just not the true super sports. It's really just the R6 and the Gixxer 600 anymore. I mean, maybe the CBR 600, but the CBR 600 needs so much work to make it race competitive.
I don't even know, like, how old... I don't know. I don't even know how behind the CBR 600 RR is behind all the other super sports at this point.
Yeah, I mean, go to a Moto America race and just count the CBR 600s RRs. Like, it'll be zero.
Yeah, you can count it on zero hands. It really is just the R6 and the Gixxer, and that's it.
Yeah, sadly. Which is kind of a compelling reason to go out and get a Suzuki, because you bet your ass that'll be the last one.
Yeah, for sure.
They'll quit making the R6 before they quit making the Gixxer 600.
But I also think it's a little bit of a false equivalence, because the naked bikes are generally they're not an analog to the RR Supersports. They're an analog to
I don't even know what.
Well, to the compromised street versions of the Super Sports.
Okay.
So, you know, a naked, you know, like the, blah, blah, blah.
I've never even liked the term naked. Just call it a standard bike.
Yeah. Well, it's like the Z650 is a naked version of an unfaired version of the Ninja 650. It's not a naked version of the Ninja 600 or the ZX6R.
Right.
So it's a bit of a false equivalence. And there are some fully fared sport bikes that are still compromised, like the you know, Honda has the
like the 500R,
like, or the CBR 650R.
I do like that one.
And I don't, well, maybe we should do a segment on this, because I think this, and well, we should listen to what other people have said, and we should talk on this, because I'm going to guess that they're wrong.
Right.
We can do this, because what I love fully fared sport bikes.
Yeah.
And just because the sales of the absolute no compromises our bikes are not selling so well, I don't think it means that we need all standard bikes.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the CBR 650R is so great because it's essentially a 90s sport bike, like 90s sport bike performance with today's reliability.
And no carburetors.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. You kind of get to live that 90s sport bike dream. You know, you're like right there with like 90 something horsepower, and they might even be getting close to 100. They're somewhere, but we said this before. It's kind of like the F4i, but just it turns out you can still get an F4i. It's called the CBR 650R.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I love that bike. I love the looks. I love the ergonomics. I love the performance. I have ridden one, and I was just like, yeah, this is the fully fared, you know, quote, super sport that you can live with day to day is what it is. It's like, oh, what if my ZX6R didn't have to be so fucking extreme all the time?
Yeah.
Like, what if it wasn't actively a pain in the ass to ride it in traffic? Right? Like, oh, that's the CBR.
What if you could have a Siberian Husky and it could chill the fuck out?
Right.
Like,
yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. So, I don't know. I've nothing, you know, whatever weird, crazy fashion trend people want to go on with motorcycles, I don't know if you think the fact that it doesn't have fairings makes it sort of semi more classic. Sure, go for it. Whatever. But it's not just arbitrarily better because that's the way the fashion winds are flowing.
Right. Yeah.
So that's my feelings on it. And I think when real 600 super sports are officially just totally gone, we're all going to feel a big loss. We're getting real close to losing all those leader bikes too. And we're going to feel a big loss. I promise you, when they're gone, you're going to miss them. You know, enjoy your 700 twins, and the 700 twins will always be fun. But there's something about having a little too much power. You know, and we're going to miss those days, right? We do a lot of talk about insane practicality in motorcycles, but I also love just stupid power as well. Like, I kind of want a bike that's maximized for either, you know? The NC750X is so cool because it's so specialized for practicality. And the Gixxer 600 is so cool because it's so specialized for stupidity.
Sometimes it's neat to have a bike that's still completely functional if the shift lever snaps off in first gear. You know? Yeah. It's still highway capable.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Does that catch us up on emails?
It does. Well, I skipped a bunch of little ones, but yeah. Just ones that were like saying, oh, caught up with the show and all that stuff. But anything with substance, I went through.
So, well, here's the question. Do we delay our how to sound like you know what you're talking about till next week?
We're at
an hour and a half.
I think it's probably a good idea.
Let's push it off till next week. Make sure we've got a topic. So next week we'll go through the subtle art of naming names. I promise you, this is much more nuanced and interesting than you think it's going to be. Think dirt bike music, right? That was way more interesting than you all thought it was going to be. That was a lot more entertaining. You're like, dirt bike music? What the fuck's that, Pete? So there was something else I was going to say at the end of this. Pretty soon, I think for season five, season eight, but like after the 5 year span here, I think we should be thinking about a new logo. You know, when we started this show, it was all cool to have microphones and headphones and your podcast logo and everything, but I don't know, it's been 5 years with the same logo and we haven't really changed it up because we haven't really come up with anything better. We have a couple alternate like designs that we have for stickers and things, but a good change up would be nice. So if anyone's, even if you can't draw, if you've just got a concept for one, send in an email with that. If you're like, oh, it'd be really great if it was like, you know, a line drawing of mountains or like a bike flying off the top of one of them or something, you know, like whatever it is, if you've got a concept that, you know, us or someone else could execute, go with that too. Sometimes, you know, someone gives you an idea and then you come up with a variation of that idea and then execute on that and that becomes a thing. But you never would have got there without someone else's suggestion. And trust me, when we came up with our original logo, we came up with probably 25 different concepts until we were sort of like, ooh, this is the good one. And then we developed that. So, you know, if you have a pencil drawing that you just want to take a shot of with your phone and email to us, that'd be cool. If you just have a description, if you're a professional artist, maybe we'll pay you. I don't know. Just at the very least, we'll send you some stickers. I don't think there's anything else. I think we can just wrap up episode. Wait, was this 198?
I do not know. I don't know why you still ask me.
It's 197 or 198. Holy shit. Well, there's only one or two more episodes before episode 200. So this one, I think, is coming out like New Year's Eve or something like that. So we got another week. So we're on target. We're on target. Anyway, yeah, send in your ideas for worst episodes, and we will see you guys in the new year after this. Goodbye. Oh, and keep fighting the dragon.
And I don't want to die. I just want to ride on my motorcycle. Cole.
I only drank 2.5 beers through this one.
Not bad.